I guess I should introduce you to my father, Christopher Wordsworth, 1914 to 1998. I'm stood at his gravestone on the Brith Deer in Llanrada, Powys. And I guess this is where our story starts. I hope you come out of the podcast all right, Dad, but either way, forgive me.
He really thought he ought to be able to have you if he wanted you.
Night. The recruiting centre for the inexhaustible army of shadows that make war on us.
Something frightened him.
I've always revelled in impersonal violence.
She stood on a grave, poured paraffin over herself and set herself on fire.
More than any other in my life, I have been the prisoner of two events. Striking a pregnant Joan. And that moment in Iraq.
I think there might have been an accident.
Hello. My name is Saul Wordsworth, and I'm an author, musician, and journalist. I'm also the son of a journalist, Christopher Wordsworth. Now, unless you're of a certain age, you're unlikely to have heard of him. He died back in 1998, at the age of 83, but he was highly regarded in his time as both literary critic and sports writer, chiefly with The Observer and The Guardian. He was even labelled Fleet Street's Prince of Phrasemakers, and is acknowledged as coiner of the expression, a legend in his own lunchtime, about a drunken colleague. To me, of course, he was just my dad, but he certainly wasn't like the other dads. For a start, he was much older, already 58 when I was born, so 65 when I turned 7. Growing up, my party piece was to reveal his age to my classmates. "Miss," they'd pipe up, "Saul's lying to us." He was impossibly well-read and able to recite great swathes of poetry from a photographic memory. And unlike the other fathers, he worked at home and well into his 80s, monopolising the sitting room during the daytime, reading novels for review, with only a brief hiatus around 2 when the distinctive thud of a book hitting the floor indicated a nap was underway. Proof copies would arrive at all hours of the day, books were piled knee-high throughout the house, and grey parcel stuffing speckled the carpet. 5'6", stout, immensely strong, yet apparently allergic to exercise, he left the house only to collect our daily bundle of newspapers or buy cigarettes, except on a Saturday when he would make his way across the country by train to report on a rugby or cricket match. Later that evening, I'd hear the rumblings of a taxi outside our Harpenden home. Car door would slam, followed by the familiar phrase,
"Good luck with the book, Mr. Wordsworth."
Words I'd mostly hear when my father tumbled out of taxis. The book would be talked of constantly, threatened even, but never showed any signs of being written.
I knew he was writing one, probably more from your mother than from himself.
That's the voice of Miriam Gross, former Observer colleague and also my godmother. Miriam introduced my parents in the late 60s, but after she criticised one of his reviews, I wasn't really allowed to see her again, and her name was never spoken in our house.
And I had great hopes for it, because I'm sure he would have done a very good novel, had it worked, you know what I mean? He had it in him to do it. He was a bit, possibly, his own worst enemy. There was a sort of self-destructive thing going on. I feel that he was a very gifted man who didn't fulfil his potential.
Sometimes I'd find him alone in a chair, head in hands. Occasionally I'd ask what was the matter. He would mutter something about bad choices and a misspent youth, before lamenting the years that the locusts had eaten. He was always generous, could be fantastically funny, with access to an endless stream of crisp one-liners, and regardless of the company, was always deferred to on matters of literature and history. Mostly, though, I remember his temper. Explosive, terrifying, constant. Two or three times a day, he'd go berserk for no obvious reason, invariably with my mum, occasionally with me. I would sit on the stairs, pressed up against the banisters, listening in. Are things calming down? I would ask myself. They never were. I hated it. Sometimes I wished he was dead. But then, as a friend of his said to me recently, Christopher had the devil in him.
When I do a summary, a summation of his life, it was just full of corpses strewn on the way.
That's the voice of my half-brother, David Wordsworth, who has few memories of our father as a child, and thorny ones later on.
I mean, he was a passing father on the way up to India, I think. Yes, on the way out. I think I can remember him reading Wee Willie Winkie to me, and I can't really remember him after that.
My father is a son of the empire and was born out in India, so David spent his early years there. David is older than me, much older in fact, but we're very close, and we've never let 30 years come between us. He re-entered our father's life around the time I was born, so I've known him all of mine. Whenever we meet, conversation inevitably turns to Dad.
There are lots of good bits, and I've rather unfairly edited those out, but at the time he provided good things, fishing, whales. He was very literary, and I was quite literary as well. So that side of it worked.
Materially, he was pretty generous.
When he had it, yes, of course he did. He flaunted it.
What was the negative for you?
How long is this section going to be?
I was 25 when he died, and having spent most of those years at loggerheads of one sort or another, knew little of his early years, which were shrouded in mystery, self-mythology, and the suggestion of some appalling behaviour. He left behind what might be termed commonplace books, a mixture of diary entries, observations, and reported speech. There were five in all, and they span the years 1953 to 63, an extended period after the war, when my dad was divorced, penniless, and living in the wilderness of Snowdonia, often without heating or running water, and trying to write the great novel. In all, he had five children by four different women, spread across 40 years, but I was the only child he raised, and so the diaries came to me. My mother, 20 years his junior, never knew him during this time. They met 6 years after the diary's end, and even if she was aware of some of their secrets, she died soon after he did. Down the years, I tried to read them, but would only manage a line or two before I'd snag on a word, and then another word, before giving up. Like so much about my father, the diaries were hard to decipher, the truth somehow hidden, impenetrable.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Thank you. Then, in the summer of 2019, I entered a pub in Soho to meet Emma. Emma specialised in transcribing documents. She asked me a lot of questions about my father, particularly the period occupying the diaries, his lost years. I told her of his grand literary ambitions, how he would survive on roadkill and trout from the local stream, his many sexual indiscretions, and of his time living with the schizophrenic wife of John Russell, son of philosopher and activist Bertrand Russell. I handed over the first of the five battered hardback books. She opened it, inhaled the musty smell, and scanned the pages. "I can do this," she said. "If you're happy with the first one, I'll translate the other four for you." A week later, a full transcript of the first diary, dated 1953, arrived.
"I based myself when younger on so much that was false, illusory. I let myself start on a course that could only end in complete personal disaster. A drunk man or a blind ass slithering down a cliff. And in the process I was stripped one by one of my protective illusions. I have arrived in my late 30s as nearly naked as is possible for a man to be, in the practical, worldly sense. Money, shelter, reputation, friends, relatives, useful acquaintances, achievements, I have none. It would have been impossible to have devised a more complete downfall in fiction. And if I were to seek a conventional career now, there are 100 disqualifications of deed, temperament, to obstruct me everywhere I turn. Poverty, says Orwell, annihilates the future."
I want to take you on a personal journey through the diaries. Within their pages, I'm hoping to get a handle on the complexities and contradictions of my gifted, generous, often terrifying, and ultimately mystifying father, and answer some burning questions. How did a man of such talent and opportunity paint himself into such a corner? What happened to him in his younger years and during the war? Why was he so volatile? It's also the portrait of a man crippled by writer's block, who will risk everything in pursuit of literary greatness. The diaries are a rich tapestry, featuring a host of colourful, sometimes questionable characters. Few are still alive, though one was recently released from prison for historic sex crimes. They paint a picture of a bohemian crowd of writers, artists, criminals and casualties, not least episode 3 and his dramatic and ultimately tragic period living with Sue Russell.
And the so-called duly appointed officer came and assessed Susan as dangerously insane.
Mostly, though, they offer insight into the character and past of my father. There are secrets, revelations, and uncomfortable truths. There are even clues that he may have been involved in a truly terrible crime.
"It is that element of calculation in it that shames me and makes it murder."
But we'll come to that. With the help of producer Paul Kobrak.
How are you feeling coming back to the family home?
The truth is, I used to feel very strange.
I also want to explore the legacy of his impact on me, to connect the dots between his life and mine. Consider the marked differences, as well as some striking parallels, not least long periods when we both found ourselves lost in the wilderness. Though where his was in the hills of Snowdonia, mine was in my head.
"He loved you so much, he wanted you to be... He just kind of smothered you with expectation."
He did. And actually, it led me to breaking point.
I've been able to draw upon interviews with his friends, relatives, and former Fleet Street colleagues, plus correspondence that has recently come to light. Mostly, though, I can draw upon the diaries.
"I'm in desperation and I've practically given up on the book. There are 12 pages written and I sit before them every morning, day after day, for the last 2 months, and cannot add a sentence, add a word. When I face that fated manuscript, it seems to me that I have forgotten how to think. Worse, how to write. It is as if something in my head has given way to let in a cold, grey mist.
My dad was born in Calcutta on Boxing Day in 1914 to Welsh parents. His evangelist mother, Mary Edmonds, hailed from Newtown, Mid Wales, and his father, William, a descendant of the poet William Wordsworth, Aberystwyth. Little is known of Mary, though William was an academic, a journalist, and a major player in India's educational policy. My half-brother, David Wordsworth.
He was a very distinguished civil servant in India and was prominent on the Calcutta Times, I think is the name of the paper. But both his parents were very, very cold. He thought that, you know, he thought he was never physically hugged or anything. That's all. But I learned this later on from him.
I suppose my father has dealt me the heaviest blow by his patent disappointment in me, and my failure as a scapegoat for his own failures. A nasty little man whom I cannot hate.
Aged 3, he was shipped back to Britain to be educated at a school in Oswestry on the Welsh borders. "Goodbye, Christopher," his mother said to him in the playground. "We're going back to India now. We'll see you again in a year."
No man, except an unnatural father, would so abandon a son. Unless an unnatural son.
This moment arrives early in our story, but could perhaps be seen as crucial to my father's skewed development, and an experience that left a wound which, untended, he would later attempt to soothe with sex, money, food and drink, or mask with ferocity.
This need to consume, to bring to the boil, get to the end, of the bottle and the current account, or the women. One shakes the bottle and rattles the women. But there is no more.
From Oswestry, it was on to prep school in St John's Wood, London. Then a scholarship to rugby school, where he indulged his love of sport and began clocking up prizes for poetry, the winning entries being airmailed onto his father in India, who would respond with silence. My father barely saw his parents during this period, and behavioural problems were beginning to present themselves.
He was thought of as a rogue, and there's no question about it, as the black sheep of the family, and also somebody who had wasted quite a lot of money.
That's the voice of my cousin Paul Wordsworth, son of my late Uncle Victor, my dad's youngest brother. Growing up, I barely saw my cousins, partly because of the age gap, but mainly because of uneasy relations between my father and the rest of his family. When I visited Paul and his wife Christine at their house outside Oxford, they were full of tales I'd never heard before.
He had once implored his sister Joan not to tell their father when he had shot someone on their land. He'd mistaken a person or a courting couple for a fox or something like that. Something strange.
Paul also offered insight into my father's time at rugby school and how his behaviour impacted his own father's future schooling.
I think my father felt that his school career might have been slightly chosen for the fact that Chris was expelled from rugby, and so the idea of sending or trying to send my father to rugby would have been not the best.
Some of this goes to explain why my father was estranged from his own family. Such was the distance between them that it spawned an episode which has gone down in Wordsworth family folklore.
The first time I actually remember meeting your father was at a game of rugby between St Mary's Hospital and Richmond Athletic Ground, where my father beetled up into the stands, sat next to a chap who, to me, was slightly reminiscent of Captain Pugwash with his beard. And they were in animated conversation and, you know, didn't take any interest in me for the whole of the game. And it wasn't until a week later when my father wrote to your father saying how nice it was to see you again after all this time, that Chris actually realised that he'd spent the afternoon in the company of his younger brother.
You didn't mishear that. My dad did not recognise his own brother. Though this, of course, is much later. Back in 1932, and notwithstanding having been expelled from rugby school for reasons unknown, aged 18, my father won a scholarship to University College Oxford, where he was tutored by C.S. Lewis, later famous as author of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. But early in his second year, he left. He was keen to pursue literary avenues, though an inheritance that had come his way and the freedom this offered may have hastened his departure. Either way, he certainly wasn't focusing on his studies. Recent email correspondence with his former college sheds further light on his exit.
Unfortunately, past moderations proved too great a hurdle for your father. The governing body minutes for 2nd July 1934 state, C.W.V. Wordsworth was refused permission to reside until he has satisfied the examiners in past moderations.
Then the following term,
decided to discourage Mr. W. from returning to the college, even if he is successful in past moderations.
And finally,
recommend Mr. W. to break off his university course and turn at once to journalism.
My upbringing. I was a toy wound up by my father. But when my wheels caught on some irregularity, there was not a guiding forefinger to help me past it and set me in motion.
There is an addendum to his exit from Oxford that may have occurred on the very day of his departure. My father was owner of a motor car. Back then, something of a rarity, especially for a man of only 19.
He'd been rusticated at Oxford for ramming the college gates of Brasenose College.
Rustication is Oxbridge speak for being sent down or expelled from the university. Whilst there is no suggestion that my father was expelled from Oxford, I've heard the college gate story too many times for there not to be some truth to it. The incident was not captured by any official documentation, possibly because, as Brasenose College informed me via email after failing to find an invoice for gate repairs,
given the sturdiness of the gates on Radcliffe Square and the cars available at the time, I wouldn't be at all surprised if the car came off considerably worse.
Whether this had anything to do with his final departure is unclear, though it may well have been a final nail in the coffin of a young man on a collision course with convention and authority.
When I was young, I behaved often outrageously. I cared vitally what people thought, and yet had the confidence to flaunt their criticism. Now I am tamed. I know what people think. The worst. I accept the verdict, except that in my heart of hearts I rebut it with the furious hate that is poisoning me. And here I am, left behind like spoil, or half-finished poems, letters, bad debts on both sides, used contraceptives, library books. These cursed 10 years in which an unspecified but golden future smashed suddenly and drove me in on myself. The best all behind me, the worst all before.
The years 1934 to 38 are pretty hazy, with no one left to shed any light on my father's life during this period. There was no career, literary or otherwise. Certainly no writing has survived, if any was done. Instead, and armed with the means for a life of leisure, he spent his time living an extravagant and apparently aimless existence, acquiring expensive tastes in food and drink, haunting London's Piccadilly, and seeking out, sometimes paying for, the company of women. My half-brother David Wordsworth.
For a man who claims to have as many sexual conquests as Casanova, if not more, women don't occur in any of his writings at all, really. They're absent. He was too self-absorbed and self-obsessed. There was no other subject but himself, really.
My wasted years were occasioned, I imagine, because I desperately wanted to be like others, conscious, even as long ago as that, of the impossibility of such a wish. Even then, in some inner labyrinth, was an oracle that made mysterious, foreboding pronouncements that I should seek and not find, knock, and it should not be opened to me. Had I been the weak and cheerful extrovert with a laxative smile, I might have been forgiven. But there was a slow, sullen fire of purpose in the stupid, wasteful way I lived that made people uneasy. From no people was I further in spirit. Among none was I a source of greater uneasiness and mistrust than the drinkers and fornicators with whom I drank and whored. And now my cry is this. I have torn my heart in two. I have renounced my birthright and overturned the mess of pottage with a kick. God give me rest. God keep me travelling still. I have dismissed my servants and companions. With my own flesh and spirit I must sustain the weight of my progress.
In 1938, he met and married Joan Darlington, with whom he had two children, Diana and David. Their wedding photograph shows an unapproachable-looking man, his goatee beard jutting out at a belligerent angle. How they came to meet each other is unclear. David Wordsworth again.
They come from such different backgrounds, and I mean, he travelled up and down on the way to Oswestry, and I don't know how he chanced upon a farmer's daughter. And,
and I guess he was going to Oswestry to see his favourite aunt, Maggie?
Yes, and a selection of barmaids.
Following their honeymoon, my father and his young bride spent some time at the family home in Ranikhet, northern India, where his siblings Joan, Ruth, Kenneth and young Victor were still living, before returning to Staffordshire and her family home. War broke out in September 1939, and 18 months later, my father vanished into the Far East, having volunteered for the Indian Army behind his wife's back. He saw service with the 6th Rajputana Rifles Regiment in India, Iraq and Malaya, though little action. His own crippling shyness revealed itself when he was reprimanded for refusing to recite a poem for the visiting Vera Lynn. More poignantly, he reasoned that to write to his young wife would only upset her, a misjudgment that would haunt him and led indirectly to their divorce on his return.
I remember my first anguish after the loss of Joan. My first awakening with a strange woman. The thought that these are not my blackbirds singing. I did not know that I had barely started my diet of bitterness. That day with her at Matras Station in India seemed to mark the apogee of my happiness. Little did I realize that happiness was gone. Perhaps forever. Her reserve I took for the shyness of a deep, still nature, when it was, in fact, aversion awaiting confirmation, and patience waiting to wring love's chicken neck. If I could be so wrong about happiness, can I ever be right again? Her exit was a greater treachery than I had dreamed possible. I must never hear myself again saying the ignominious words of love.
Foolish though this decision not to write might have been, there was another, more relevant narrative at play here, one that I often observed growing up. My father's habit of offering a neatly packaged anecdote in response to a difficult question, drawing the asker away from a darker truth or masking a more complex backstory, one that invariably reflected badly on him. Here's David Wordsworth again, who by now you might have guessed doesn't have a very high opinion of our father. The fallout from his parents' separation made David's life challenging, in modern parlance. Being raised by him may have been a mixed experience for me, but at least he was there.
I just think his faithlessness was fairly apparent. I don't think he tried to hide it. very well. I believe on the boat back from India, he was putting it about a bit.
Like a Duracell bunny.
And I think that really sealed everything.
You mean with your mother also on the boat?
Yes, yes.
Womanizing was a feature of my father's life. His apparently pathological desire to seduce as many women as possible. 300 is the number quoted in the diaries. A story told to me by my cousin's wife, Christine, is not dissimilar to others I've heard.
When we first moved here, we were invited down the road to the big house, Christmas drinks. So down we toddled. He said, Wordsworth. Oh, I knew a Wordsworth. He ran away with my fiancé. I thought, uh-oh, here it comes. It'll be Chris. He said, yeah, I think he's a journalist now. And she was an Italian princess, apparently. And he'd skedaddled off with her for a while.
And my cousin Paul.
Superficially, we were never quite sure how many times he was married. Or how many partners he'd had. I mean, it was a standing joke within the family.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My father was finally discharged from the Indian Army in April 1946, complete with demob pay. However, with his divorce to Joan now underway, any inheritance long since squandered, and a proven inability to live within his means, he soon hit the skids. It was in early 1947 that a genuinely shocking episode occurred. Whilst house-sitting for his sister Joan and her husband, my dad attempted to sell their property from under them for cash, only to be thwarted at the last moment. My brother and I shrug when we hear such tales. They are apparently endless, with new ones still seeping out of the woodwork. But they show an unscrupulous man, not given to consequences in the feelings of others, or even the simple matter of gainful employment.
I think he was very disappointed in life. He had, which I have vestiges of myself, believing that the golden apples would fall into his lap without too much effort, because he wasn't a man of effort. And of course, on that account, he was. Many others have been disappointed. You have to labour for it. And he didn't.
A cache of letters retained by his ex-wife Joan recently came to light. They include this one, penned by my father from Bayswater, London, in 1947, to his wife's own brother.
Dear Tom, this letter will surprise and disgust you. It need not surprise you, even though it will arouse your contempt. We always come back to where our heart is, like a dog to its vomit. But there is a millionth chance that you might help me. And I must take it. It would be idle to describe what is happening to me. There are no questions of the rights and wrongs of it. I once possessed a pearl and lost it through animal carelessness, and because events played havoc with me before I understood the... My loss and the problems of my own strange nature have made an outcast of me. And even if I can succeed in what I am so painfully doing, I know I cannot now hope for the peace and happiness that crown a normal life. I have found a shelter here, where I might have sorted things out. But I am in bitter financial trouble, and these people, my friends, cannot afford to keep me while I resolve my destiny. If you have read this far, can you help me? There is no reason why you should, and it is not certain that you will be repaid this side of the grave. I am going down for the third time and clutching at straws. If I surmount my crisis, I will find some way of thanking you adequately without intruding on your lives. Now, I can only pray. Yours sincerely, Chris.
Another letter, this time written to his ex-wife Joan in 1948, was penned on the eve of his return to Malaya, a place where he knew he could hide out and at least find some means of support.
He went to Malaysia because everything was failing and old Blighty, I think, and yes, he liked the army life because he was regimented. He liked being quite liked not having to worry about problems, and problems were his métier.
My dearest Joan, just a letter, the last. I thought I would write to you to let you know what I have decided to do. I am going out to Malaya in the new year, either in the police or, if the divorce has made it impossible for me under the Colonial Office, as a planter. I shall make you an allotment, and in the former case there will be a pension should anything happen to me. I think it unlikely that I shall come back. I have woken to a deep sense of my unworthiness. Losing you, I lose everything, and my actions since have been those of a body without a head or a heart. I cry at night sometimes, and I have no wish to continue. I shall have written my book first. There will be a time lag before it is published. The profits, if there are any, will be yours. And there will be an envelope for you in the bank in the event of my death. To this day, I am puzzled as to how my life has taken the turn it has. You were right about the wishful thinking, of course. But a lot of this was the East, and trying to bridge distance in one's mind. I have learnt a lot about myself. I can take a detached view, and from what I know of the ingredients in my character, I should have made a pleasant and successful person. Yet I have done no good, made no one happy, not even myself. When I think, my dearest, of the pattern I reduced your life to, and loving you throughout the distraction, and willing to give my life to you, I am driven to beg for forgiveness. I suppose that I have always been more afraid of life than death. You know I was gentle with you. Twice I struck you. Once when I was being a selfish swine at the Oaks, and I could have cut my hand off thinking about it in India. And once that awful night in Ranaket in sheer anguish. Darling, I am saying these things not to justify myself, but hoping I shall one day be something other than a monster in your memory. When it no longer matters, you will appreciate some things. You will admit that my inordinate sexual appetite, as you called it, was a perfectly healthy love twisted by all the imaginings of absence, the perversions with the ordinary currency of any lovers. I enclose a check. I have had to post-date it. Perhaps I shall be able to send more next month. Always, Chris.
Oh, Dad. So you hit your first wife. Based on other excerpts, she was pregnant as well. And what was this pattern you reduced her life to? And what, specifically, were the perversions? No, don't answer that. Oh, and based on solicitor's letters retained by his ex-wife Joan, the cheque mentioned at the end of the letter? It bounced.
In 1950, after 18 months spent hiding out in Malaya, my father returned to these shores. Reluctant to move back in with his parents, who were by now holed up in a cottage near Dover, his father months from death, his mother bedbound with an array of physical and psychic ailments, he descended upon his maiden aunt, Margaret Edmonds, in Oswestry. Maggie, his mother's younger sister, had always spoiled him. According to my father's brother Victor, soon after moving in, my father spent £200 of Maggie's money in one night, some achievement back in the early 50s, especially in such relatively pastoral surroundings. It may have been this event that stirred Maggie, possibly at the behest of my father, to put pen to paper in another begging letter to his ex-wife's brother, Tom.
My dear Tom, Yachida and a very happy 1951 to you all. Tom, I'm in great trouble. Could you possibly lend me some money, say £100 or £200? Dear Chris is in great trouble with me. You know, Tom, he still loves Joan through all and wants to provide for her and the children, who he longs to see. His book is nearly ready and will be published in the spring, if we have the money to live on until then. Will you think it over and do your best for us in the long run for Joan's children? As you know, I'm sure, I'm not well. Dear Tom, please help us by lending. You shall have it all back with interest, and I will send you an IOU as soon as I know you'll do so. I'm writing because I think you will help us in this our great trouble. With love to you all, from Margaret E. Edmonds.
With Aunt Maggie ailing and the money gone, my father returned to London, taking a room in Bayswater and quickly becoming bedmates with the landlady. But when he couldn't meet the rent, she kept him on as a butler or manservant, demanding odd, often unnecessary jobs, one of which was to iron her nightgown every morning before, presumably, removing it later that night.
The abyss of humiliation is when you are offered not bread, but a stone. And recognizing the stone, to cover it with butter, salt and pepper it lavishly, and eat it with every appearance of enjoyment and gratitude. What I need is a change of circumstance that can restore me some self-confidence, however shallow-rooted, dispel my obsession with my own affairs and troubles. Give me some detachment.
A change of circumstance is exactly what was awaiting my father, one that would alter the direction of his life.
Well, Christopher Brooks, Jeremy's brother, met him in London.
That's the voice of Eleanor Brooks, artist and widow of playwright Jeremy Brooks.
And he told Christopher that he was halfway through a novel, but he'd run out of money and had nowhere to live. So Christopher Brooks said, oh, my brother is in the same state as you. He's trying to finish a book. He lives in North Wales in this derelict cottage. They only pay 10 shillings a week rent or something like that. I'm sure they could put you up. So there we were landed with him.
And so it was that in 1953, at the age of 38, my father moved in with the Brooks family, in a cottage called Gethley, near the village of Llanfrothan, in the unforgiving landscape of Snowdonia. It was his first introduction to the shifting circle of writers, artists and bohemians in northwest Wales, an area that would become his home for the next 10 years. And this is where the real story starts. The diaries begin, and our journey truly gets underway.
You ready, Paul?
Yep, let's do it.
Let's get this show/podcast on the road.
Next time on Devil in the Wilderness.
But the way he commanded through even his silence an entire room full of people was both extraordinarily entertaining but also terrifying.
I wondered if he was actually afraid of something catching up with him.
Above all, the two calamities of Iraq and Joan, so complementary, destroyed any creative impulse.
I wonder if you can help me.
Yeah, sure.
My father volunteered for the Indian Army during World War II, and he was posted to Iraq. I found his Indian Army details.
This despair, not black, but limitless. A violin on a refuse heap. A curlew's song in the mist. A child with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Devil in the Wilderness was written and produced by me, Saul Wordsworth. Original music from the series, such as this track, is also by me and is available on Spotify and other streaming services. Links in the show notes. The executive producer is Paul Kobrak. The voice of my father is performed by Chris Porter. Other voices in this episode, in order of appearance, are Marcus Smith, Amy Rosenthal, Chris Chakraborty, and Emma Pardo. This track was mixed and mastered by Eric Homberg at K51 Studios in Stockholm. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss future bonus episodes.